Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture and urban design. I'm joined here today by Lauren Hyams, Head of Urban Nature Activities at the Natural History Museum, and Neil Davidson, Partner and Landscape Architect at J&L Gibbons. We're here today to talk about the Natural History Museum's fantastic goal to connect people and nature with big science and learning, and transforming the 5-acre garden site at the Natural History Museum. Hi guys, welcome.
Hello.
Thank you.
So why don't we kick off by telling us, what is the Urban Nature Project and how did it come about?
As everybody, I'm sure, listening knows, but we are facing sort of biodiversity and climate crises at the moment. It's going to affect us all and it requires action from us all. And I think in the UK, we are one of the most nature depleted countries because we got started on our industrial revolution first.
Right.
And sort of loads of us live in cities. We're doing this from London. And that is meaning that sort of nature and wildlife is struggling. Children, I think, especially in the pandemic, everybody noticed that children were spending less time outside. And it's very unequal, the inequity
of access.
In access to nature. And this really affects both their well-being now, but also their ability and desire to protect wildlife when they get older.
Yeah.
So all of that, and that we don't know much about how to sort of mitigate those environmental challenges that we're all facing in terms of biodiversity loss, especially in our cities, means that we want to sort of develop scientific tools, we want to connect children to nature, and we want to sort of help people take action. And all of that together means that the Natural History Museum wanted to start this Urban Nature Project. The beautiful building that everybody knows and loves in the Natural History Museum, designed by Waterhouse, was always intended to have a garden setting, but never quite happened. Right. The story is that they ran out of money, which is probably familiar to anybody who's done any projects. So with all those challenges that we're facing, and to finally give the Waterhouse building the setting it deserves, is sort of our aim for the project.
Fantastic. So it will connect people with nature, but also be a living place to do research and learn from as well.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And join people who are visiting us with that project, so they can join in when they come and visit us.
From our perspective, we've been involved since 2019. We formed a team with a brilliant architecture practice called Field & Fowles, and with lots of amazing specialist engineers and other consultants. And we did a limited competition response to the Natural History Museum. And obviously that's been a challenge because that's basically been working right the way through the pandemic.
Right.
So it's had its extra issues to overcome.
Right.
But I think that's really helped focus a lot of minds, because the pandemic has really brought to light some of these issues that Lauren was talking about, you know, the importance of access to nature in cities, the kind of challenges when we were all sort of locked up and we weren't allowed to kind of wander into our local park or even just do a bit of exercise at that time. It really sort of brought into focus the issues that we have. In many ways, this project is very unique because it can set some examples for how we should be designing nature into cities.
Yeah, it's got an opportunity to really set a great high standard, hasn't it, for how we engage with nature.
Definitely. And share that with all the people that come and visit us. So I think before the pandemic, we were lucky enough to have about 5.5 million people visit us a year.
Wow.
So if a percentage of those people enjoy their time in the gardens and sort of pick up some of the messages about connecting with nature and noticing that change over time, then that would be an amazing thing.
Yeah. And 5.5 million people, that sets some of its own design challenges too. It's not often you have to consider that in terms
of that kind of footfall. Yeah.
But it also extends to, you know, people wanting to sit in groups and be social, people want to sit on their own and quietly observe. So you have to find different moments across the gardens to allow those different moments of relaxation or different moments of kind of just being kind of having fun and relaxing and being slightly informal, because the museums, it's got that nice balance of formality and informality. So we need to find something like that in the gardens too.
Absolutely. It makes learning a joy in the museum. So you want to carry that through to the garden.
Yeah. And we were lucky enough to have a summer before the pandemic hit on the design so that we could observe how people use the space now. And, you know, people having their picnics, school groups, taking a minute out of the sort of hot, busy galleries in their day and making sure that we're sort of both building in new experiences but also allowing them to enjoy the space that they need to use that green space for.
We know that you want to connect people with nature and connect big science and learning. What in sort of 5 years' time, when we look back on the success of this project, what does that look like for you?
I think it looks like the museum working with our visitors and audiences in a different way. So whether you're at school in Nottingham, or whether you're visiting us in London, or you're a family that wants to use an online experience with us,
right,
that you can come to the museum to connect with nature, and we can help that happen to people where they live. I think it's about developing the sort of scientific skills and tools. So there'll be toolkits, there'll be eDNA. So if you're working in a park or a garden, can you come onto the Natural History Museum website from next summer and download a toolkit that will help you with acoustic or eDNA monitoring, for you to monitor the health of your habitats where you are.
Just for me, what's eDNA?
Environmental DNA. So I'm not a scientist, but I'll try and explain this. So getting a sample of soil or water or air, and then understanding all of the different species that have been through that sample in order to understand the health of that habitat. And that understanding better the species and the health of the habitat means that we can sort of manage and monitor better for that.
And will that data also be collected?
So this is all very new technology. So we've got a load of scientists. So the Natural History Museum is not just a visitor attraction. It's a scientific research institute. So we've got about 300 scientists.
Wow.
And there's a group of them that work on UK urban nature. And they are developing these new tools. And it's not about sort of developing those tools, but it's also about how to share them,
right,
so that lots more people can access. And one of the new things we've learned in the project is loads of people in community gardens, especially, and parks, want to sort of help develop those tools and that sort of scientific monitoring. But, you know, we've got ecologists.
Right.
We've got scientists.
They need somewhere for a bigger place for it to be collected and used.
Exactly. Yep. So, yeah. So we've got 5 science sort of sites that we're developing those tools with at the moment. So our gardens in London, Kelvin Grove in Glasgow, National Museum of Wales in Cardiff, Belfast, and the Countryfile Garden in Bristol.
Uh-huh.
So those are the sort of sites that we're developing these tools and then hopefully be sharing them with lots of people from next summer.
And for you, Neil, what would success look like for you? Obviously, it mirrors what Lauren said, but you've probably got another focus as well.
One of the most exciting aspects of this project is the challenge for us as designers to create outdoor exhibitions.
Yep.
But one of the biggest opportunities we have when you're working with plants is that you have living, dynamic exhibitions, which you can't do with much success indoors. So the fact that we're actually designing with the seasons and thinking about this garden growing and being nurtured by people, brings a whole new aspect to the learning opportunities that the museum's so keen to deliver through the Urban Nature Project. And I think one of the things that Lauren and our colleagues talk about is this idea of creating sort of ambassadors for the planet.
Right.
So really encouraging young people to take an interest in their surroundings, particularly nature, and think that that might be some kind of career path to go forward. Because we're at a pretty critical moment in the Earth's history where we need people who are engaged with nature, who have the skill sets to really make transformative changes to battle the biodiversity and climate emergencies that we have to, you know, have to be dealing with now. A lot of the targets we're talking about are quite far out in sort of, you know, 2050 or 2030, but we have to be making action now.
But that means a six-year-old now is going to be having that impact. It has to be on that path to making that impact.
Yeah. Yep. So we've very deliberately designed in lots of narratives, some of which are explicit, some will be part of the, you know, interpretation, some of which are just there and can be told. So, you know, maybe curated through a kind of activities like the ones that Lauren will be programming, because it's one of those things, we want repeat visits. We want people to come back one day and look at Dippy, the new bronze Diplodocus. And the next day we want them to really focus in on pollinating insects in the planting, or to come back to that same area in the winter time and see something completely different. So really dynamic kind of experiences. And for us, that's really what success will be like, is kids wanting to come back time and time again to see something else.
Yes. I mean, it's an amazing scheme or program to be on, because you have so many layers as a landscape architect to be thinking about. Now, thinking about it, it's not a scheme. It's used in different ways and you want people to experience in different ways on each visit.
Yeah. I sort of... slightly jokingly, but it's true. I sort of feel like a 5 or 6 year old again on this project.
You're seeing the awe of it.
It's because the potential for learning is huge. And it's lots of things I was interested in when I was that age. And a kind of really, you know, it's such a unique opportunity to think about outside exhibition. Yeah. So we've done a huge amount of case study research internationally. And as Lauren says, there's a few museums starting to look at their outdoor environments, but there's not many that have really done it on this sort of scale.
Right.
So again, you know, talking about exemplars, this feels like an exemplar project in that respect.
And hopefully this becomes the case study or the best practice for others to then learn from and build their own projects.
Yeah, definitely. And we would love to do that and to learn and share with other museums and find out what other people are doing all around the world. I think there's so many people at the museum excited about. So when you come into the museum and people often are coming in and they want to see the dinosaurs, it's really hard for lots of us to understand that concept of deep time and evolution and when the dinosaurs came about and really understand that. So usually you would be telling that through label text or an exhibition or a gallery or a science educator explaining something to people. But the chance to tell that part of the story through plants and geology as people are walking through a garden is really exciting. And I think it's just going to bring that whole new way of telling that story and immersing people within that story. So they, as they walk through our gardens, is really exciting.
And I think as well, we are really keen, and the museum's doing a great job of recording the process, because we've got some really, really high sustainability targets on this project, you know, being carbon neutral, but also thinking about where of all materials coming from, reducing sort of the miles that they have to travel. In terms of geology, the UK is brilliant. It's got pretty much 3.5 billion years worth of geology within its shores. So we can kind of set up this map of discoveries around the country. And they're being brought to London to be sort of put in a showcase, an outdoor showcase.
Yeah.
But then that then connects people to kind of other places in the UK, you know, the museums that Lauren talked about, but also other landscapes.
Right.
And that's really exciting,
so
I think.
So you see something in the Natural History Museum gardens, but then you might want to go to the Jurassic Coast to go and see where it came
from. Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, there's not many projects where we set up a meeting collectively with the museum to go down a mine to look for dinosaurs footprints. But we've done that on this project.
That's a good field trip.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's about that sort of excitement and encouragement of learning beyond the museum, which is really important.
Must be very satisfying to work on.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And it helps, and don't blush when I say this, but it helps that we've got an amazing client as well.
Yes.
So, you know, I think these sorts of projects rely on a good design team and client relationship.
Yeah.
And we'll maybe call it a collaboration, because it's an exchange of knowledge between technical experts, whether they're scientists or technical experts, whether they're landscape architects.
Yep.
And then thinking about how you create a setting for activities to be programmed.
Yeah. So Lauren, tell us a bit about your role in the project, and what does this project mean to you, and what do you love most about it, if you can pin it down?
I think you'd be here for quite a while if I tried. So I'm the activities program lead for the Urban Nature Projects. That's sort of designing nature engagement programs on a national scale. And I project manage the sort of delivery, work with an amazing team, both in our office in London, but also partners across the country. So museum educators in Glasgow and Leeds and Newcastle, all our funders and our audiences. I feel incredibly privileged to take part in this program. It's the most amazing project. You know, the chance to work on something that will change how the museum looks and for our visitors. Also, we're changing how we work and how we work with audiences, how we work with schools, how we work on science learning projects. So it's an incredibly sort of transformational project, both in terms of our gardens, but also the way that the museum works and who we work with. So it's absolutely brilliant. And it could be anything from sitting with Neil and the team planning the visitor experience and how the replica Diplodocus cast is going to look surrounded by its tree ferns, to training teachers in Glasgow at COP26, to two Saturdays ago, sort of being in our wildlife garden on Saturday morning, training groups from the Ismaili community to look at flies. So all of that is within the project, and I love it all.
Yeah, and there'll be a legacy of children and adults that will have changed their mindset and what they want to do from it as well. Yeah.
Especially when, as Neil was saying, it is all about children and understanding the challenges that they are going to have to face. And quite a lot of the time, I think it's easy in the UK to think about those challenges affecting other people somewhere else.
Yeah.
But actually, when you've got young people in the garden and they're having a think, you know, and they are absolutely wowed at seeing the worms and the tadpoles and the birds in our garden, and then sort of getting them to understand that that nature is changing too, as well as the rainforest, as right. well as the things happening to somewhere else. So it's all about sort of bringing that forward, and it is amazing.
Thank you. And Neil, tell us about your role in the project and what you love most about this project.
As I said earlier, we're working very collaboratively with Field & Fowles architects, and that's a nice opportunity in a way, because this project is as much about landscape as it's about the new building, mm-hmm. so the Learning Activities Centre and the Garden Cafe building. So there's a real balance between architecture and landscape, which is sometimes a bit unusual. And I think we really enjoy this dialogue between the two practices. And obviously with all of our other specialists, we've got soil scientists, we've got hydrologists, tree experts, you name it. There's kind of every specialist you could possibly imagine have been involved in this, both on the design team side, but also from the scientists within the museum. And the thing that I like to say about this project is I feel like every day is a school day on this project. Right. So we're designing with a palette of materials. Some of the materials are familiar. Some we just don't design with on a day-to-day basis. The sort of the concept for the gardens is you start in deep time. So you're sort of going 500 million years ago, kind of is where we really start to sort of showcase when life emerged from the oceans onto land. And then that happens in the East, this kind of journey from the Precambrian through to the Anthropocene.
Yep.
But then in the west of the gardens, we have the pre-existing wonderful wildlife garden, which we're delicately enhancing.
Yeah.
And then as we move around into the Darwin Courtyard, you then have an opportunity to project and think about what future urban landscapes are going to be like. So it's a real journey of discovery.
Right.
And I think it's really interesting because I do feel that we've learned an incredible amount about the sort of the geological resources we have in the UK and the challenges that we have. You know, some of them stones that we're sourcing, they're not coming from quarries because those quarries don't operate anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we've got stuck in this cycle of importing from all over the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, actually we should be thinking about recycling and reusing where we can rather than buying new materials. And that's got to be a fundamental kind of driver for every construction project now is really being careful about the materiality and the specifications. And this project is doing that for everything. So we're analysing every single material, looking at its carbon footprint, looking at what its lifespan might be, thinking about what the replacement might be of that sort of material. So really weighing up the kind of the environmental impact materials. And then where we can, trying to create as little waste as possible from the project.
Yeah.
And you know, we work on a lot of projects that talks about doing this sort of thing, but doesn't actually deliver.
Yep. And you've got a client now who is completely engaged with wanting the same outcome. Yeah.
And I think, you know, if the Natural History Museum can't do it, then who can? And so, you know, we kind of have to keep reminding ourselves that this has to be really pushing the boundaries.
Absolutely.
And that carries through from sort of the idea of the brief to design through to construction, and then really importantly, how it's cared for going forward. So we have a management maintenance plan, but we talk about caretaking is how we describe it, really, because this needs to be a site that can grow and get better from the day that our role kind of finishes. And that's why it's important. There's a head gardener, a team of expert horticulturalists involved, but then lots of volunteers being recruited. And it has a life that's, I mean, I slightly joke and sort of wind up my architectural colleagues, but really on a project like this, once the building's finished, then that's as good as the building's going to get. But once the landscape's finished, that's the starting point.
It just gets better, doesn't it?
Yeah. So that brings together a lot of things that we're interested in as landscape architects.
And I think, as you say, I think we hear a lot from landscape architects that the vision is there, but you don't always get the alignment in the execution for the goals in terms of sustainability and the lifetime of the project.
Mm.
But to have a client that's exactly what the client wants with the Natural History Museum is brilliant. Hopefully we'll see more of these schemes, and as they become more normal, that you can refer to them and say, this is what successful is.
We can't think of these sorts of approaches as nice to have, and everybody collectively needs to buy into that if we're going to really kind of reverse the impacts we're experiencing. I mean, look at the weather
today,
at the moment. Yeah.
This is a new concept, really. What was the thinking? What was the lead up to bringing all the strands together, and what was the impetus to kind of moving forward with the whole project?
So the museum has been trying for many years to develop our grounds, but in 2020 we launched a new strategy, and that was incredibly important to so many staff at the museum. And that sort of strategy was in response to the planetary emergency, and strategies built around a vision of a future where people and planet thrive. And that ethos is all about a hope that by working together, we can change the current path. And I think that strategy and how everybody at the museum's work then feeds into that strategy is really exciting. And that has been a massive part of the prompt to look for designers, architects, contractors who are also committed to that mission on this project. Yeah. And it means that we're trying to like live those values through this project. And that means taking all of the sustainability KPIs and targets that we've set ourselves and all the challenges around that in the build and with the design of the activities that sort of prompted the design of the whole program, both in terms of what we're going to see in our grounds in London and also the activity program around that. So I think it was the museum's strategy that came in 2020 that really prompted this way of working and this approach. And we can't wait. And this is sort of going to be the first real sort of project that lives that strategy and brings our visitors and audiences with us on what we do. So we can't wait to sort of have this as our showcase.
Flagship, yes.
Exactly.
And I think it's like any project that is that ambitious, there's obviously going to be some obstacles. In some cases, that's going to just be lessons learned because the industry as a whole, the kind of construction industry is, you know, one of the largest polluters on earth, mm-hmm. one of the biggest contributors to emissions of carbon. But actually, kind of like when you go right down the supply chains, there are certain areas where we really need to be doing better. Some of the things we've been looking at is the site in South Kensington presents its own challenges right in central London, kind of all of the associated issues or restrictions in terms of the type of vehicle that can get there. So when it comes to construction, we have to be thinking kind of outside the box.
Yep.
So, you know, we've got contractors looking at electric fleets, electric plants, but then working out actually electric plants, batteries are quite short-lived.
Yes.
Or JCB apparently has a hydrogen digger.
Right.
So looking at these sorts of things, and it might be that we're just a bit too soon in that evolutionary process in terms of the construction, but it means that there's a conversation happening that's pushing all supply chain.
Absolutely.
Really.
And then you'll have contractors who are thinking about that for other projects. You're giving them the opportunity to move forward with those strategies.
Yeah. In that sense, I think there are some new concepts, and maybe it is this idea of being holistic. So it's you know, the urban nature project in its entirety, the construction project is actually kind of a smallish part of the whole thing. And it really is about, well, fundamentally people and nature, as Lauren said. So,
when you stay true to your values, then it's very clear what you do, what's acceptable and what's not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not easy, and it's providing lots of challenges, but it's definitely something that we're all committed to trying to make happen as much as possible.
Absolutely.
And again, if we can get this project through to delivery when we've got a pandemic, we've just got all of the challenges of Brexit in terms of import, export of materials, and a war in Ukraine, which is all having a major impact on the whole construction industry, then we must be doing something right, I think.
Yes.
And the challenges in schools with COVID absences, with pupils' behaviour. So when we're, again, trying to talk to teachers, you know, it's that setting. But teachers are still responsive. They do still want to take part in sustainability and climate education programmes.
Yep.
So it's just on us to try and find the best way to make that fit with what they want to do and to make it fit, how it can work in their classrooms.
With a lot of the work that you've done, how have you engaged local communities and what have you done to involve those, not just in London, but presumably in outreach as well?
Yeah, so we have done a huge amount of consultation when we were designing the programme. So we created a theory of change for the whole programme to sort of move people along to improve biodiversity and well-being for our audiences across all of the different programme activities. And we've spoken to teachers, parents, all over the country on sort of what they need, especially those sort of first stepping stones to connect children with nature, and especially those who are furthest away.
Right.
So we've spoken to loads of people, some specific examples of working in our boroughs in London.
Right.
So we've got an amazing group of young people from North Kensington, from working in partnership with a charity called Nova New Opportunities. So we've got 12 young people that come to the museum on Sunday mornings once a month, and they are young people who are documenting the changes in the gardens.
Right.
So they're taking photographs. So when we had the Museum of London archaeologists digging a trench to make as part of our planning permission,
right,
the young people came and took photographs and they saw the foundations of the Great Exhibition. which is really exciting. They have also been taking photographs of the pond because that is changing. They've been taking photos of the garden as spring came. So those young people are documenting the changes. And by the end of the project, we'll have 2 years of those young people's photographs to show the changes both in the gardens and on the project. So within the gardens, when families come to visit us from next summer, there'll be some trails that people can follow. So self-guided trails that they can pick up as a family. And we've been working with Meanwhile Community Gardens, a local school, St. Thomas's, and Pepper Pot, which is a sort of day centre for Caribbean elders to come. And they have all helped us tell stories in a trail around Anansi.
Right.
The spider garden, the gardens that lots of primary school children tell. And they've made films with us. And so when you come to the gardens next summer, guided by Anansi, go around and sort of understand the wisdom from the trees within our gardens, as told by Anansi. Working with those school groups and the elders have really helped showcase that story within our gardens and create that visitor experience, that really memorable visitor experience from next summer onwards. So there's loads of examples of how we're working with our local community in the boroughs. And actually, we've got a celebration event on Wednesday night where we're going to be welcoming and we're going to be showing those 9 kids that took part are all bringing one of their parents or guardians. The elders are coming with a family member and we're going to screen those films at the museum, give them something to eat and drink and really sort of celebrate all of the work that's been going on.
Wow, what an experience for them.
And this is an unusual project in that we've got a team of absolute experts in terms of community engagement in the museum.
Right.
Not that I'm saying we kind of didn't want to be involved in the process, but really it was kind of over to the museum to run these activities. Then what we did was we had engagement sessions with the museum, people who had been involved in that, and they could feedback the results. So I mean, some of the very specific stuff in the early days of the project were about sort of interpretation and color, you know, heights of panels and accessibility of those panels for different age ranges. So it's been, you know, very detailed responses to design challenges, but also kind of thematic stuff, really, is about storytelling, because a lot of this is storytelling, and as Lauren was just saying. And so that's helped us think about kind of the character of spaces, the size of some of the paths, and allowing different flows and different spaces, and what we describe as primary routes for mass flows of people, but then discovery routes, which allows that kind of more intimate learning experience.
Quiet, contemplative. Yeah.
So it's been really, really interesting and remarkable that they've been able to do it through this unique period we've come through. So,
one example was, I think the first thing that we did with you, first sort of proper activity that we had you guys do once we'd appointed the design team, was that we took you pond dipping in our gardens, which is, the pond dipping is going to be sort of one of the blockbuster activities that school groups and families can do in the wildlife garden, because it's such a great hands-on, practical, immersive activity to do in the gardens. So we took the design team and we sort of made them do the pond dipping as if they were the children. And I think it really worked because it really focused you guys on what the best pond dipping experience would be. Mm. And that really led to you guys coming up with some amazing ideas.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest obstacle to overcome was, how do you safely allow a child to kind of lean over an edge of a pond and do some pond dipping? So our design solution is to bring the water to the kids.
Right.
So we have a sunken path that goes through the pond. And so the pond will have varying levels of access in terms of height. So different ages can access it, but it's always going to be at a safe kind of waist height relationship to the water. It makes it easier to kind of get that pond dipping tray to a table, so an outdoor classroom. So really thinking about holistically about that whole learning experience. That was great. And we're talking about kind of engagement with communities. I mean, the museum is surrounded by a very diverse community in terms of embassies, and you've got schools, and you've got kind of large residential areas. It's a real mixture of kind of stakeholders.
Right.
So we've had to work out a way of describing the project that's suited to the audience that you're meeting. So I've been part of quite a lot of fundraising activities. And you'll meet people who are super interested in the sustainable aspects of the project. So you can present it in one way to one audience.
Right.
Or you might find another group who are really, really interested in how the activities will be contained in different spaces. It becomes much more about the space and the character and those sorts of things. Landscape architects probably all need to be a little bit better about describing their projects. This one's been quite unique in many ways, particularly when you're talking about, you know, plant species that first came about 350 million years ago.
Wow. So Lauren, tell us about some of the urban nature project activities across the UK.
So we have been working in partnership with the Prince's Trust because we know that one group of young people who are most at risk of being not connected to nature are teenagers,
yep.
and especially disadvantaged young people. So we've been working in partnership with the Prince's Trust to train their youth workers in running activities that are about connecting their young people to nature where they live. Because I think a lot of those youth workers, and we work with Voyage, which is a youth group in London, and the Prince's Trust, and the perception of those youth workers, maybe before the pandemic and before they started to work with us, was that they understood the well-being benefits of their young people connecting to nature, but they thought they had to do that. So if you're a youth worker in Manchester, the only way to do that is to take your young people on a sort of outward bound trip,
like a week-long residential course,
exactly.
and then it's done.
Exactly.
Right.
And they didn't have the skills or confidence to actually think about, could you take your young people to a local park and do some activities there? When you're walking them to some football training, can you walk along the canal and have a chat there about the sort of species that they can see and the lichen on the wall? So we've developed this day's training and toolkit that's available online, which is all about sort of reframing urban nature and giving people activities that are all sort of scaffolded for different age groups, different things that you need to do it, so that those youth workers can run those activities with their young people. And we delivered that sort of last autumn to about 90 youth workers. We've got another one coming next week where we're training the youth workers to then train their colleagues.
Yep.
So it's like peer-to-peer training. And I think with any training product like that, you ask people on the day, did you enjoy your training? And they'll always say, yes, it was a great day and we liked the biscuits, and then go home.
Right.
But the impact is, has it changed their practice? Are they actually delivering the activities that they were introduced to on that day? And we are really happy. So we contacted lots of the youth workers that we trained in the autumn in May, so 6 months later, mm-hmm. and said, have you done anything different? Are you using these activities with your young people? And loads of them said yes. They've been running loads of these activities with their young people, either as specific like activity days or just as part of their everyday practice when they're on a walk somewhere, having a conversation, stopping in a park. And so that is brilliant for us, and we would really like to sort of see that model through working with the youth workers who know their young people the best and can adapt those activities and adapt to the cities across the UK. So we've delivered that training in Birmingham, London and Glasgow.
Right.
So that's sort of one example of the kinds of activities we're doing. We also have another programme called Explore Urban Nature, which is a national programme aimed at young people who are key stage 2 and 3, so upper primary, beginning of secondary schools. And that is working with partner museums across the UK who have natural history collections.
Right.
And it is all about getting those young people to go out and explore the urban nature in their city. So in Nottingham, in Glasgow, in Birmingham, in Leeds, in Newcastle, young people are going and having workshops at their local museums and then really exploring the urban nature that surrounds them. And then once young people have sort of done some investigations, they're sending their questions about, could be about air pollution, it could be about temperature, to the Natural History Museum. And we're going to turn that into a sort of a young people led citizen science project. So most citizen science projects sort of asking people to go out and gather data, but this is about actually based on what the young people are interested in. So we're really interested to see whether that makes a difference in the young people taking part, because it's all from their sort of young people's concerns.
Yep.
Once they start to connect, understand and have the confidence to sort of develop those working scientifically skills across the country.
But it does take the role of the Natural History Museum to lead and bring together all of these different strands in the different cities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But each city and each museum is adapting it to make sure it suits their young people.
Yeah.
So, for example, in Belfast, they're working with young people who have special educational needs.
Yep.
So it's adaptable. So the programme isn't just being set in London.
No, that's fair.
It's museum partner, and each city can adapt it to best suit their habitats and their young people.
And Neil, how is the green space being transformed, and where did the ideas come from in terms of how you evolved the design of the 5-acre site?
Well, when we started, we had a very detailed brief from the museum. And as is every designer's prerogative, you started by challenging the brief. But, you know, it was wonderful in a way because the kind of the key drivers for the project, we've held true to them throughout. So initially, it's kind of four things for the site to be accessible and to allow repeat visits.
Right.
To think about sustainability being embedded into the designs, to improve or extend habitats and improve biodiversity, and to create a learning landscape. I think that's kind of just about summarized it. And so we then responded to that with 12 sort of criteria that we tried to work to. But I think probably some of the most interesting ones were, for example, in the wildlife garden, which is a pre-existing fantastic resource, was to adopt an approach that was about light touch,
right,
treading lightly, enhancing what was already there. So in some ways, that's not really a transformative bit of design. Whereas compared to the Eastern Gardens, we're going to make a new fully accessible ramp connection to the London Underground. So that will allow people to come straight out into this immersive landscape of geology and tree ferns.
Wow.
And hopefully that's the response that we'll get. But it's kind of, so it's finding those moments of wow, and wonder, and please, kind of asking questions. I want to find more out about this. And then, I mentioned before, kind of really thinking about recycling and reusing materials, so being very sensitive to our finite resources. So using what's on site where we can, and that includes soil and moving soil around and working with the existing soils to create a really rich tapestry of habitats, which is driven by what's going on underground, the things you can't see that are so important to the health of the plants above. And the other one I think that I find quite interesting is we described it as kind of encouraging people to look closely. And, in terms of senses, that could be listen closely, but it's really allowing opportunities to observe in a different way. So in the wildlife gardens, a good example, whilst we have moments where you can walk around and look at the pond from the sunken path, that gives you a slightly different perspective. We then have these huge chaise long kind of carved pieces of tree, which allow you to lie back and look at the canopy. Or we have other moments working with Gita, who's been working on the 3D interpretation, where you have kind of magnification and kind of really looking at nature in a way that's more explorative. And I think that's exciting. So it kind of, it's helped us to have these sort of this framework to work with them. Then it's kind of about kind of doing research and development. We've done a lot of research development with about materials and about aggregates and how we can create different paths and how we can create what one of the main features, which is a timeline wall,
right,
which is going to showcase the geology. So, again, it's been a great opportunity to prototype and test, which is not always the case on every project. You kind of hope that's what's going to look like, but actually we've got physical examples, and
Brilliant. That's
been good to bring other stakeholders within the museum. Because the museum's a huge organization. So Lauren and her colleagues have had to kind of, be talking to all of the museum staff and the kind of the volunteers and all that sort of stuff to bring them along on the journey too.
Right.
So a bit of transformation in the East, it's a bit about enhancing in the West. And in the Darwin Courtyard is very much about experimentation. So we've got a warming climate. What is urban nature going to be like? We've got certain data that's suggesting that London is a Mediterranean climate already, and that the plants that we need to be planting need to be the most resilient plants that are native to the UK, but do we have to start thinking about introducing Mediterranean species?
Right.
So it's really, that's going to be an area for live experimentation. What can respond well to no irrigation and warming climates? Or how do we use the water in a way that is much more sensitive?
Yep.
So all of the water in the grounds, none of it's going in a drain. It's
right.
All going into the landscape. So it's a fully integrated strategy in terms of precious resources. So it's, again, another exemplar. And when we were talking to the local authority, they were saying, particularly in this area looking forward, we could see there might be potential here where we can look at what urban tree pits might look like in the future. So, that would be interesting for us to use this as an exemplar for other projects.
So you can use this project as also showcasing of new, you've been given the opportunity to experiment more, and you can use some of that, the best of those can be used in other projects.
And that benefit of the way the grounds are shaped.
Right.
And the way the museum was designed originally, it was, the East Wing was looking to the past.
Yes.
And the West Wing is the kind of more present. But it does allow that. And the way that we're presenting the East is very much a kind of from day one, there'll be a real immersive experience. But we'll still be evolving. Whereas actually, in the far West, in the Darwin Courtyard, that's very much about need to be carefully interpreted because there might not be much going on for a couple of years because things will be growing or things might not work out. And that's okay in that context.
Well, we've talked about the engaging both children and the communities within the gardens and the network of programs. What role does science and technology play within this ambitious project?
Yeah, it plays a really strong part. We're piloting a range of new technologies for monitoring change in urban environments. So as Neil said, if there is a sort of experiment about tree pits, how do you actually know whether something's working or not? And that is through our scientists monitoring it. And those new techniques include the environmental DNA and acoustic monitoring,
right,
and sharing those with partners. The whole point is that the science monitoring and developing these tools will make it easier, quicker and cheaper to monitor those urban habitats, because it will be lower cost, more efficient and more effective. And that is to share with people all over the UK. So that's sort of a really important intention for our work, and sort of creating those large open scale data sets of information, yeah, that will help researchers. That's really going to sort of drive forward the research and conservation around those urban habitats. So that level of sort of science and technology is going on in our gardens and the other science sites across the UK. Then there's a whole thing about how we share that with our visitors. So one of the things that has sort of prompted audience research and sort of user visitor journeys across the museum is that we know that people struggle sometimes to understand that sort of deep time. And when you're in the wildlife garden, and 8-year-old boy asked me, where's the wildlife? Because they don't see plants, didn't see the worms, the tadpoles.
Right.
He was just looking for a tiger.
Yes.
So based on how do you bring all of that sort of hidden wildlife, right, how do people stop and notice, and how do you sort of bring that forward to people? And that's sort of all the plans that Neil was talking about, the sort of different ways to look and to connect and to spend time. So all of that goes on. So it's not just about sort of the science and technology, but then it's about communicating that and creating visitor experiences where people can enjoy that within the gardens. Mm. So that's what we're doing as well.
Yeah, I remember very early on, and it might have been a question I put to you, Lauren, or somebody, where I asked, can I have a list of all the species that have been recorded in the wildlife garden? And ended up getting sent a 22,000 page document. And it's one of those things, it's like, if you know how to look for it, it's there. And so being able to explain that is really important, you know. And there's another fact that I heard where, or I hope they'll get this right, but there's three species of moth that have been discovered in the wildlife garden that was the first discoveries in science.
Wow.
And that's really? Because you've got all these experts,
right,
on the doorstep.
Yeah.
And so it raises some really interesting questions about what is actually in other urban spaces that just don't have those kind of expert eyes looking,
gosh,
at them.
Yeah.
And I think for the challenge in terms of the design is then to find a kind of, create a network of infrastructure to allow this monitoring to happen and to predict how that might change as well. So try and future-proof it. So that's what we've been trying to do. So
it's a wildlife garden. It's beautiful, but it's not like a remarkable space. It is an urban habitat. It's right next to the Cromwell Road, which is like one of the busiest, I think it's the second busiest road in London. And so if all of this nature can thrive
there,
and we have the scientists to be able to spot the moths and all the other things, and what can be going on in all of the rest of the parks and gardens across our cities, and how can we bring people into identifying and helping support all the rest of that nature? Mm.
So in the east, where we've got, and this is one of the things you have to learn on the Urban Nature Project, you have to be able to recall the geological eras. So pre-Cambrian, Cambrian, Devonian, Carboniferous. I could keep going. But what's interesting to me is we've got plants that are mimicking what would have been around in the Jurassic period when,
right,
the dinosaurs were there. That habitat will be monitored. We don't have Jurassic gardens that,
gosh,
in many locations.
But it's
so,
like,
you know, and there are moments in the timeline, for example, in tropical London, where that's basically at the moment in time in Earth's history where kind of flowers started to appear, quite recent in terms of deep time. And so that's going to be great for pollinators and all sorts of things. But, you know, being able to really kind of look at what species, which kind of historic species are actually providing real benefit to current insects and bees and things would be fascinating. Yeah, it's very exciting.
How can people get involved? You know, the backgrounds, the opportunities, how can the community get involved?
Well, loads of different ways. First of all, teachers or educators, parents can go onto our website and find out about how to download learning resources and book a visit either in London to the Natural History Museum or in their local museum and bring their young people to take part in the programme. So I think that's the first thing to say to people who work with young people. There is a way, hopefully, people will come in 2023 to the museum and enjoy the transformed gardens for themselves. And we can't wait to see what it looks like and how people are enjoying the space. There are loads of ways to take part this summer. So we are asking people to join us in spotting flies this summer all over the country to improve our understanding of some of these sort of important pollinator species are faring in the UK. So our scientists have nominated 10 species that they're really interested in finding out more about. We don't know enough about them, and without knowing what species are important and where they're found, we can't do what's needed to protect them and support them. So on our website, again, we've got a list of 10 species. We've got some really fun activities, and we're asking people to, when they're out in their park, when they're in their garden, take some photographs and sort of tell us what are those pollinators you're seeing, and that really will help us build a better picture. So that's sort of our asking people to take photos of flies they see in their local area and improving our knowledge of the populations and geographic spread of those flies. And it really helps us to understand that. So I think that's definitely something that we're asking people to help us with this summer, especially in the heat. It'd be really interesting
lots of flies.
See exactly lots of pollinators and flies going on. And there is also a bit of work launching this week, which is the final stage in our fundraising strategy, where we've got a range of sponsorship and naming opportunities in those gardens, from sponsoring a square meter of grass to engraving a name on one of the new benches. So if anybody would like to sort of remember or honour someone they love or show their commitment to nature and protecting the planet, they can join us and they can find information on our website. So that'd be all the different ways that we'd love for people to join us.
So Neil, what's one thing that landscape architects and the landscape architecture profession can do right now to help combat the climate disaster?
As landscape architects, we're uniquely positioned between arts, sciences and humanities as a profession. And that gives us scope to also empower communities, I think, in our work. So I really think if you're working on a project and the brief doesn't require you to be minimizing waste, reducing carbon footprint, encouraging your client in its broadest sense to be engaged in the project, then you need to find a way to make that happen. And it's possible. It's something we do on all of our projects. We've been doing it for the 35 years of our practice, is to really be proactive. And I think the time for landscape architecture being seen as something that fills in around the edges is no longer acceptable from a professional point of view. We need to be pushing the envelope and really telling people what we can do. That's one of the biggest things, is communicating better, whether that's in terms of the way we draw stuff or the way we talk in podcasts, or actually getting out there and finding ourselves in forums that are a bit unusual for us. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have all over the world now in peer groups which have no other landscape architects in them.
Right.
We're talking to people who define policy or people who are running city governments or a really kind of diverse mixtures of people who are all interested in healthy cities.
Absolutely.
Or healthy planet.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be one of those voices.
Seat at the table.
Exactly.
I think we've described it. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And really, just to say, that's not easy.
No.
So it requires determination. It requires persistence. But, you know, we all need to be doing our part. And I think landscape architecture, in a very positive sense, has the skill set.
Absolutely.
To do that.
Why do you do what you do? And what do you love most about it?
This goes back to the point I was talking about earlier about telling people what you do. It was by chance that I became a landscape architect. I'd always intended being an architect. Mm-hmm. And then in a careers brochure, I saw this thing, landscape architecture. And I was lucky enough to do a work placement when I was still at school in a practice in Edinburgh, which was one day architecture, one day structural engineering, one day mechanical engineering, and one day landscape architecture. And that kind of that kind of switched a box in my head. I've always been interested in nature. I think there's quite an interesting sort of heritage of landscape architecture in Scotland. And I studied in Edinburgh, but grew up in Scotland too. And I think it's kind of a profession that has very broad scope if you want it to, or it can be very, very specific. Mm-hmm. So in some ways you can sculpt your career to suit what you're interested in. It's also a career that allows you to travel. I mean, I've worked in Holland, I've worked in the States for a bit, studied in the States. It's a very transferable skill set.
Right.
And that itself is quite interesting too. And a lot of people I know have done the same. They've worked in all over the place. And as a practice, we're quite international in terms of people who work with us. That, again, is quite interesting. So I think at the moment, the thing that I love most about being a landscape architect now, because of the stage I am at in my career, is about passing on and sharing knowledge. And trying to, in some ways, like the Urban Nature Project, make that knowledge more accessible. So yeah. Joanna and I, my other partner, Janelle Gibbons, we set up a social enterprise a few years ago called Landscape Learn, which is kind of its driving force is open source, shareable knowledge, recording of knowledge that's being lost. This is something we're seeing a lot. We're seeing a lot of experts in their fields getting to retirement age and not kind of passing on that knowledge.
Right.
And we see that a lot in different places, whether that could be in a large forest. It could be in a kind of very specific field like mycorrhizal fungi or something, trying to find a mechanism for sharing that knowledge. And in a way, doing it in a way that links academia and practice. So bringing those, kind of squishing those two things together. Uh-huh. So learning through doing is something that I'm really interested in.
So Lauren, where would you put a bench anywhere in the world? Where would it be?
I was having a think about this, and as we've been talking about like access to nature every day and sustainability, I thought I wouldn't put a new bench somewhere. I maybe would just celebrate a bench that already exists, because I am lucky enough to sort of be able to walk when I go into the museum halfway through Hyde Park, and it is just amazing. It's like the best part of my day sometimes. It's really beautiful. And so yeah, to not put something somewhere new and an everyday joy about connecting to nature, it would be one of the benches in Hyde Park.
Love it. That's brilliant. And Neil, where would you put a bench anywhere in the world?
In the Naturist Museum Gardens, perhaps. is that the right answer?
Correct. 1 point to Neil.
But no, I am sort of joking aside. I think we have some really interesting opportunities that we've designed in to sit and observe. Yeah. And some areas which are quiet, and some areas, as I sort of said before, are really about social engagement. So I think this is a brilliant thing about finding places to sit. And also, I think something we're maybe not very good at as landscape architects is putting benches, for allowing people who don't have the kind of the accessibilities of everybody else
right.
to pause and sit and rest, allow them to enjoy everything as well.
In the same way, yeah.
So that's my bit of kind of sort of slightly contrived answer to that one, but
well, yeah. I would hope you'd want it to be in the garden, right? Yeah. You've designed it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, both of you, for coming in. This has been a really awesome conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.